They will do anything to make profit from these people. It's human trafficking at its max. The Biden administration is finally ending the policy after court battles, but it's unclear how and when things will change substantially underground. Alma Maquitico, director of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, said at the same time, Title 42, ostensibly a pandemic-related health measure introduced in 2020, closing border ports of entry and allowing the Border Patrol to summarily expel migrants without asylum hearings, has contributed to the deaths in Brooks County, Texas, and beyond. Alma Maquitico said, Title 42 has led to a rise in deaths. People aren't crossing at cities anymore, but in more faraway, dangerous areas. They are dying in the desert. Eddie Canales also pointed to the rural, arid expanse. Contrasting it with its scorching desert namesake in California, he said, this is the real Death Valley. He added, the U.S. immigration system has failed. The government wants to blame the cartel, but not the policy that is creating this problem. The solution is to offer an ordered asylum pathway. You could fix this tomorrow. A spokesperson for the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, which oversees the Border Patrol's 20,000 agents working between the land ports of entry, claimed the death toll was the fault of traffickers. They said in a statement, criminal organizations continue to recklessly endanger the lives of individuals they smuggle for their own financial gain, with no regard for human life. Despite these inherent dangers, human smugglers continue to lie to migrants, claiming the borders are open. The borders are not open, and people should not attempt to make the dangerous journey. Although Brooks County in Texas is about 70 miles from the U.S.-Mexico border, it has the largest Border Patrol checkpoint in Texas. Located along U.S. Highway 281, one of the few northbound highways along the hundreds of miles long South Texas border region, the checkpoint processes an average of 10,000 vehicles, traversing the busiest route from Mexico and Central America to the United States each day. According to Deputy Sheriff Don White, like other deterrence policies, the checkpoint, instead of reducing the number of migrants trying to enter the United States, has driven them into deadly routes. People smugglers, often known as coyotes, demand thousands of dollars to help migrants cross the Rio Grande on rafts, usually to McAllen, Texas, where they will hide in dirty, cramped, safe houses. Migrants will then be dropped off 50 miles north on sandy back roads before being sent on a days-long trek across brutal terrain, where temperatures regularly exceed 100 degrees Fahrenheit during the ever-hotter Texas summers, and drop below freezing in winter in order to avoid the checkpoint. According to Oscar Carrillo, a sheriff in Culberson County, Texas, which is also dealing with a surge in bodies, smugglers often send groups of migrants in camouflage gear as well as with backpacks of cannabis, allowing them to reduce the fees owed by delivering the contraband to a contact if they survive the journey. In February 2020, Oscar Carrillo apprehended a group of more than 50 people en route. Carrillo says they are given an itinerary like a cruise line, adding, there's been a huge rise in attempts to cross, but it's a dangerous place. There are snakes, mountain lions. If they can't continue, they'll be left behind. For those who make it over the first hurdles in an attempt to reach densely populated cities in Texas, such as Houston, Dallas, and San Antonio, where they can live under the radar of the authorities, the risk is far from over. In June of this year, 53 migrants, mostly from Mexico, were found dead inside a sweltering tractor trailer on the outskirts of San Antonio, Texas, in what was the nation's deadliest smuggling incident along the U.S.-Mexico border to date. According to data from the Customs and Border Protection, CBP, since 1999, more than 7,500 migrants from Mexico, El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and beyond are estimated to have died on the U.S.-Mexico border. According to Eddie Canales, most of these deaths can be attributed to heat stroke or to dehydration, who maintains 90 water stations out in the brush. He said, yet the real number of deaths is probably far higher due to limited data and a lack of support from federal authorities. Since 95% of land on the southern border of Texas and 99% in the Brooks County is private, ranchers and farmers on the remote plots, some as large as 50,000 acres, are often the ones that discover the recently or long-deceased people. Brooks County Sheriff's Office estimates it finds only one out of every five bodies. Eddie Canales says, it's a burden that falls on volunteers. It's usually us who have to deal with the bodies. Yet Canales and his team of volunteers can only achieve so much. An analysis by the Center for Public Integrity found that more than 2,000 of the bodies of migrants recovered in the United States have not been identified. The National Institute of Justice has called the ongoing tragedy of missing persons, which leaves families unable to properly mourn, the nation's silent mass disaster.
Iran is a country rich in culture, history, and art. The countless historical monuments scattered across the land are manifest proof of the glory of the ancient Persian civilization. And the development of modern-day Iran is evident in its major cities and metropolitan centers. But perhaps what's remained hidden from both foreign and domestic tourists are some of Iran's stunning natural treasures. I'm Daniel Arya. As the 18th largest country in the world, Iran offers a full gamut of climates and geographical attractions, from mountains and deserts to forests and caves. Iran's diverse and dramatic landscapes offer some truly awe-inspiring and unspoiled views to discover. In this week's program, we'll follow Javad Gharai, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the southern regions of Iran, where the hot sand dunes of the desert meet the turquoise and tranquil waters of the Sea of Oman. Stay with us.
Travel is the most important thing in life to me. The reason I travel so much to the unknown spots of my motherland is that I want to discover the hidden beauties of its environment and to meet its diverse ethnic groups. I believe that city dwellers, with all their knowledge, education, and modernity, must have a good relationship with the natural environment and with nature dwellers in order to live a richer, more peaceful life. A relationship like this is vital for our survival in the world we live in. It's early February. In this season, temperatures can plunge to minus 40 degrees in the towering Mount Damavand region. But I've come to a part of Iran where the temperature is as high as 20 degrees above, perfect for a good long trip in the winter. I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and this time I have traveled to the southernmost spot in my beloved country, Iran. Follow me to one of the most beautiful and pristine areas of my country, in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. To be exact, my destination is the southernmost area of the vast Balochistan region. In terms of culture and ethnic groups, Sistan and Balochistan province is divided into two parts: Sistan in the north and Balochistan in the south. During my many trips to the natural beauties of beloved Iran, I have come across multiple beautiful mountains and spent time traversing most of them, from freezing tall rocky mountains to forested highlands to those sitting on the hot and dry deserts of Iran. But this time, on one leg of my trip to Sistan and Balochistan province, I'm supposed to find mountains that are impossible to climb. The shape of these mountains, or should I say hills, is unique and beautiful. The locals and tourists who have visited this area have named these hills Martian Mountains. Many believe that the rocky formations in this part of Iran are very similar to those on the surface of planet Mars. Geological experts say these hills are sediments at the bottom of a sea that used to be here millions of years ago, were initially buried under millions of tons of soil following the change in the shape of the Earth's crust over the years, and were later unearthed as a result of climatic changes and monsoon rains that washed away the dirt, exposing the real face of these bizarre hills. These mountains are among the most beautiful in Iran, in my opinion. They are no less beautiful than Mount Damavand that's been registered as a national heritage. I hope the Martian mountains of Sistan and Balochistan province, of the Balochistan area in the Chabahar region to be exact, are also put on the national heritage list. The thrust of the Gulf of Oman oceanic crust under the southern area of Balochistan, in addition to wind and water erosions, are among the reasons behind the emergence of these beautiful elevations. They are made up of sedimentary rocks containing clay and lime. The beautiful furrows on their exterior have been carved out by centuries of erosion. The heights of Martian hills vary from one area to another. At their shortest, they stand at more than 5 meters tall, and at their highest, more than 100 meters. At first glance, these hills, referred to as badlands by geologists, may look like they are not very resistant, but you will change your mind once you inspect them up close, although they're not resistant enough against the rain and water of Balochistan. In the midst of these mountains is a plain where rainwater has accumulated over many years, creating a spectacular lagoon by the name of Lipar. Environmentally, Lipar, with its many and varied animal and plant species, is an important lagoon in the region. It is an important feature of the natural environment in Balochistan. The local population use water from the lagoon for their animals and in farming. I'm on my way to one of the most beautiful valleys in the Martian Mountains. I've named it the Snail Valley. If you want to know why I picked that name for it, follow me. We walk for about an hour to get to the mouth of the valley. Flat waters set off by seasonal rains have created a beautiful and unspoiled valley and cave. This is the Nahadig Cave. It acts as the entrance to the Snail Valley. My good friend here, Shir Muhammad, was kind enough to come here from Berries to help me find this cave and walk through it to the valley. I'm sure we are in for a treat. Am I right? The valley, I mean the Snail Valley, is a very long and deep gorge that leads to the Terap Mountain. Terap is what the locals call that mountain. The reason I named this the Snail Valley is because this place is littered with shell fossils. You can see them everywhere in this mountain and in this valley. Beautiful shell fossils that have adorned this boulder and this whole area. All the exterior walls of these Martian or miniature mountains and inside the Snail Valley is covered with these shells that have turned into fossil. Another reason is that this valley looks exactly like a snail. It meanders through the mountain from beginning to end. In some places, it wraps around itself and sends you going around in circles before you can get to the other end of it. The Snail Valley is so curvy. It's one of the most beautiful gorges in the Balochistan region. And let's not forget that if a place has a local name attached to it, we should never try and put a new name on it. We must follow the tradition of the locals who have inherited that name from their forefathers, from their ancestors. So once again, we should use the same names as they do. The gorge is almost impassable in some parts, but I am so enchanted by its beauty, I've decided to move as far as humanly possible. Its many twists and turns and the millions of fossils on its walls have redoubled my resolve to move forward. We are around 10 kilometers away from the Sea of Oman. This is a very high altitude. Obviously, thousands, in other words, millions of years ago, this whole area had been under the Sea of Oman, part of what used to be the Tethys Ocean. These fossil shells date back to that time. These are millions of years old. Every time I step into valleys or Martian hills like these, I'm filled with utter joy. But I'd never take any of these back home with me or use them as ornaments. All I do is pick them up, snap photos of them, and put them back where I found them, to share all these beauties with posterity. We must protect these treasures. We are their guardians. We walk a long way and eventually arrive at a dead end. That's when we have to trace our way back. Fortunately, there are no construction operations going on anywhere close to the Martian Mountains, and that adds to the beauty and magnificence of the area. After my visit to the Martian Hills, I continue my journey to one of the most beautiful semi-traditional wharfs in Iran, the Berries Fisherman's Wharf. It is operated by the inhabitants of Berries village, perched on top of these escarpments. Before the village was relocated to the top of the coastal cliffs, it used to be somewhere on the sand beach. Today, the locals call it Old Berries. The villagers moved from Old Berries to New Berries around 20 years ago. One of the most important reasons for their relocation was the strong winds in the area that would blow for 120 days in a row and dump sand and dust on the village. The second reason was the beautiful Berry's Wharf. The architecture used in the homes and other buildings in Baluchistan has vividly been inspired by Indian and Pakistani architectural designs. They use different, beautiful, vibrant colors in their buildings. The old mosque here is located in the area where old Berry's used to be. The rest of the village lies in ruins. They stripped the old buildings of their doors and windows and used them in their buildings in new Berry's. But they have left this mosque intact. Everything in this mosque is there, just as it has always been. That's because the Muslim population in Baluchistan have utmost respect for their mosques and sacred buildings. They never demolish them. They abandon such buildings and let nature take its course. The main occupation of the people of Berry's is fishing. The men of this land depend on the sea for their livelihood. Some strike out to the sea in small boats and throw their small nets in to catch fish. Others go out in wooden launches, which could be called the biggest of man-made contraptions. They go out to sea and spend months fishing. These large wooden motorboats are equipped with proper refrigerators and air conditioning for the crew. The fishermen here say they are not happy with their catches in recent years. They say marine life populations have shrunk drastically. The declining numbers of fish in seas and oceans has its cause in different and important reasons. The first reason behind the decrease in the numbers of marine life around the world is the boom in the human population on Earth. The growth in the human population has led to a larger demand for fish and in turn to overfishing by those in the fishing industry. Operations that are carried out via large ocean-going trawlers fitted with radars and other high-tech equipment. Ships that have nets running several kilometers and by means of radars can trap thousands of fish in every attempt in the depths of oceans. In almost every catch, these ships bring home fish weighing upwards of 300,000 kilos altogether. Industrial fishing and the overconsumption of marine life by humans leaves the fish no time to reproduce, pushing many species to the brink of extinction. In a recent survey, researchers at the University of British Columbia found that in half a century, human consumption has pushed down big fish populations by 90%, fish that are in high demand on the market. They have predicted that if serious action is not taken against overfishing by developed countries, all these species of fish will have gone extinct by 2050. Marine life populations are on the decline, which will have dire consequences for humans and the environment alike. The ecosystems of seas and oceans are intertwined with the lives of humans and the environment they live in. They're all very fragile. Iran accounts for only a small portion of the marine life caught around the world. The reasons being high prices, the small share the marine animals have of the Iranian diet, and the absence of advanced fishing vessels in the country. But European countries, the United States, Japan, and many other developed countries play an important role in the destruction of marine ecosystems. They have done more damage to the environment than any other country in the world. And this is a result of a boom in their populations, a change in consumption patterns, and the lifestyle of the people living in those countries. There are two other important reasons that have contributed to the dwindling numbers of marine animals: contamination and global warming. Berris is a very beautiful wharf. It was built at the foot of the Berris Cliffs, offering a spectacular view. Launches and boats return here with their catch of the day to sell their prized sea creatures to the middleman. Beautiful the fellow is. The local fishermen here call it the kilkita in their local dialect. It's so colorful. Unfortunately, she too is still carrying her eggs. They get caught in the fisherman's net in this season. Most of those I've seen were ready to spawn. This is their time to reproduce, but they don't get the chance to do it. They are pulled out of the water along with the thousands of eggs that they are carrying in their abdomens. Poor thing is struggling to get out of my hand. Just look how beautiful it is. So colorful. One of the fishermen gave me this lobster and said I could have it, but I'm gonna let it go because it's carrying so many eggs. After my visit to Berris Wharf, I set off on a walking journey along the shores of the Sea of Oman. Of course, I'll be walking on the cliffs all along. The view from atop the cliffs in Berris is simply matchless. Fortunately, there aren't constructions of any kind up here. The area is an asset for Balochistan and indeed for Iran because of its pristineness. I hope to see the same unspoiled beauties and pristineness the next time I visit this part of my country and its beautiful landscape. I hope more and more tourists come to visit Balochistan. Nature travelers go to places that are pristine and untouched in order to immerse themselves in the peace and quiet that those places offer. Beautiful rocky cliffs that you see here are where Berris begins. Those are the shores of Berris, among the most beautiful of our beloved country, Iran. But the bluff along the shore is crumbling into the sea. The waves lap at the walls made up of millennia-old sediments that settled on the bottom of the Sea of Oman that used to cover this whole area. The bluff is capped by a 2-meter-high layer of rock, like the one I'm sitting on right now. It feels like reinforced mortar with all the shells and algae in it, fossils that have been here for thousands, or should I say millions of years. But the layers underneath are weak and brittle, allowing the waves to chip away at them one bit at a time. The green blocks or rocks that you see on the coast are in fact the top layer of the cliff. They used to be up where I am right now. It's going to take the waves some time to turn them into sand and dissolve them in the water. It's about 60 meters down to the foot of the cliff. And as you can see, a huge slice of the cliff has splintered from the rest, or should I say from Barry's territory, and will crash into the sea one of these days. So I better cross onto the other side because it's dangerous to stand here. I really don't want to go down with it. This gaping crack here is almost 10 meters deep, but it's very likely for it to be much deeper in other parts. It's too dark for me to see. This is a very dangerous spot.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
America has conducted nearly 400 interventions since its founding, with more than a quarter in the last 30 years. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Nick Terse, writer. This article is published under the heading, Since 9/11, the U.S. has increased military interventions to historic levels. Here's more. The United States has conducted nearly 400 military interventions since 1776, according to innovative research by scholars Siddhi Takushi and Monica Duffy-Toft. Half of those conflicts and other uses of force, including displays and threats of force, as well as covert and other operations, occurred between 1950 and 2019. The last year covered in a new data set introduced by Cushy and Toft in a Journal of Conflict Resolution article published earlier this week. More than a quarter of them have taken place since the end of the Cold War. The United States has carried out 34% of its 392 interventions against countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, 23% in East Asia and the Pacific region, 14% in the West Asia, North Africa region, and just 13% in Europe and Central Asia, according to a newly refined version of the Military Intervention Project MIP data set, a venture of the Center for Strategic Studies at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. Until the end of the Cold War, note Cushy and Toft, U.S. military hostility was generally proportional to that of its rivals. Since then, the U.S. began to escalate its hostilities as its rivals de-escalated, marking the beginning of America's more kinetic foreign policy. This recent pattern of international relations conducted largely through armed force, what Toft has termed kinetic diplomacy, has increasingly targeted the West Asia-North Africa region. These regions have been both larger-scale U.S. wars, as in Afghanistan and Iraq, and low-profile combat in nations such as Burkina Faso, Cameroon, the Central African Republic, Chad, and Tunisia. The MIP data incorporates confirmed covert operations and low-profile interventions by special operations forces, but a combination of U.S. government secrecy and the data set's scrupulous souring standards guarantees that post-9/11 tally is an undercount, according to Kushi, an assistant professor of political science at Bridgewater State University and a non-residential fellow at Tufts Center for Strategic Studies. Recently, for example, Alice Sperry revealed the existence of low-profile proxy war programs run across Africa, the West Asia region, and the Indo-Pacific region. While experts say that the Pentagon has likely used the secretive 127E authority to carry out combat beyond the scope of any authorization for use of military force or permissible self-defense in violation of the Constitution, such highly classified operations may evade capture in the MIP data set. While 127E programs in Somalia and Yemen, for example, overlap with known U.S. military interventions, other uses of the authority, such as in Egypt and Lebanon, may not. The same goes for even lesser-known authorities like Section 1202, which provides support to foreign irregular forces aimed at near-peer competitors. As the MIP is further developed and refined, Kushi and Taft hope that it will allow for a more nuanced understanding of the conditions that cause the United States to launch military interventions and the effects on the U.S. and the nations it targets, including the economic and human toll and inadvertent outcomes. What they ask were the longer-term costs and unintended consequences of the intervention in Afghanistan, and how did that intervention influence U.S. engagements in Iraq, Libya, Syria, and Yemen? The answers they hope will lead to improved data and, ultimately, a better U.S. foreign policy.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered on January 23, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the eulogists of the household of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa ali on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha.
What kind of place is a hay'at? It is a place for struggle on the path of Allah. A hay'at is the center of struggle on the path of Allah. It is struggle on the path of Allah to revive the school of the Ahlul Bayt, the school of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and the school of martyrdom. Well, in what kind of endeavor were the Imams engaged in? The Imams did not engage in military struggle except for a few of them. Only the commander of the faithful, Imam Hassan Mujtaba and Imam Hussein fought with swords. The rest of the Imams did not fight with swords. So, what was their struggle? It was struggle for clarification. When I repeatedly speak about clarification or the struggle for clarification, the hay'ats are places for the struggle of clarification. In my opinion, from this sentence, keep our issue alive, this important point can be understood. Another point about the hay'ats is that they are an institution that enjoys meaning, movement, and dynamism. They are not only places for thinking, spirituality, studying and teaching. Movement and dynamism exist in the Hay'at as well. The main issue is the school of thought and clarification of the school of thought.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In the Hay'at, the school of thought is clarified. When I say that it is clarified, I mean that it should be clarified. This is the nature of Hay'ats. They are places for clarification and expressing the most important teachings of Islam and Imam Ali. These are places for answering questions. Today, our youth have various questions regarding lifestyle and other fundamental issues, and their questions are legitimate. The way to deal with questions is to think and answer them, and this should be done in Hay'ats. The important centers for such endeavors are Hay'ats. It is in Hay'ats that the numerous questions that arise every day should be answered. It is all right to have questions, but he who has a question should know that it is due to his lack of knowledge that his question has arisen. This question can be turned into knowledge and understanding. A person who has a question should not think that everything is upside down. No, his question should be asked, and that's all right. The answer should be provided in Hay'ats, in centers of knowledge and understanding. This is the meaning and essence of Hay'ats.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
The lack of insight into what the U.S. Justice Department intends to do with the investigation into the former U.S. President Donald Trump's unauthorized retention of government documents has deeply frustrated the Trump legal team and aides alike in a week of perilous moments for the former president. We now present you an article written by Hugo Lowell. The piece is titled U.S. Justice Department Asked Not to Disclose Affidavit Behind Mar-a-Lago Search. The U.S. Justice Department has asked a judge not to release the affidavit that gave the FBI probable cause to search Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort, worsening distrust among top aides casting about for any insight into the intensifying criminal investigation surrounding the former U.S. president. The Justice Department argued the affidavit should not be unsealed because that could reveal the scope of the investigation into Trump's unauthorized retention of government secrets, just days after the Mar-a-Lago search warrant showed it referenced potential violations of three criminal statutes. FBI agents recently seized around a dozen boxes of materials, including documents marked top secret, executing a search warrant which referenced the Espionage Act, outlawing the unauthorized retention of national security information that could harm the United States or aid an adversary. The Justice Department said the affidavit would serve as a roadmap to the government's ongoing investigation, providing specific details about its direction and likely course of action, adding that it did not oppose unsealing both a cover page and a sealing order that wouldn't harm the criminal investigation. In arguing against unsealing the affidavit, the Justice Department also said that the disclosure could harm its ability to gain cooperation from witnesses, not only in the Mar-a-Lago investigation, but also additional ones that would appear to touch on the former president. Prosecutors added, "Disclosure of the government's affidavit at this stage would also likely chill future cooperation by witnesses whose assistance may be sought at this investigation as this investigation progresses, as well as in other high-profile investigations." The existence of potential witnesses who could yet cooperate in a number of investigations against Donald Trump, seemingly people with intimate knowledge of the former president's activities, rattled close advisers once more on Monday, further deepening distrust inside Trump's inner political circle. The lack of insight into what the Justice Department intends to do with the investigation into Trump's unauthorized retention of government documents has deeply frustrated the Trump legal team and aides alike in a week of perilous moments for the former president. At least one lawyer on the Trump legal team, led by former Assistant U.S. Attorney Evan Corcoran, who also acted as the lawyer for Trump's top former strategist Steve Bannon, has called up a reporter covering the story for any insight into how the Justice Department might next proceed. It added to the already fraught atmosphere inside the reduced group of advisers who have day-to-day roles around Trump that erupted shortly after the FBI departed Mar-a-Lago and sparked suspicions that a person close to the former president had become an informant for the FBI. That speculation came in part amid widening knowledge about how the FBI might have established probable cause that there was a crime being committed at Mar-a-Lago using new or recent information to prevent the probable cause from going stale through a confidential informant. According to multiple sources close to Donald Trump, suspicions initially centered on Nicholas Luna, the longtime Trump bodyguard who stepped back from his duties around March, and Molly Michael, the former Trump White House Oval Office operations chief who remains on payroll but is due to soon depart. One of the sources said, "Nicholas Luna was subpoenaed by the congressional investigation into the January 6th Capitol attack but has not spoken to the FBI about this case. And a source said, although Michael is slated to also leave Trump's orbit, her departure, like Nicholas Luna's, is not acrimonious. The sources said the focus in recent days shifted to Mar-a-Lago employees and other staff at the members-only resort in Palm Beach, Florida, seemingly in part because the FBI knew exactly which rooms and where in the rooms they needed to search. The sources said, but towards the weekend and following the revelation that the FBI removed a leather-bound box from the property and already knew the location of Trump's safe, scrutiny shifted once more to anyone else who had not yet been suspected, including members of Donald Trump's own family. A spokesperson for the former president did not respond to a request for comment. Calls to Trump lawyers went unanswered or straight to voicemail. The Justice Department declined to comment on the investigation or on Monday's request. Nonetheless, the sources said the escalating distrust and rampant speculation about an informant has started to reach dizzying levels, even by the standards of the Trump presidency, which was characterized in many ways by competing interests and political backstabbing. It remains unclear whether the FBI relied on confidential informants, and The Guardian first reported that the search came in part because the Justice Department grew concerned that classified materials remained at Mar-a-Lago as a result of interactions with Trump's lawyers. Confirming a New York Times report, the sources said at least one Trump lawyer signed a document, apparently falsely, attesting to the Justice Department that there were no more classified materials left at Mar-a-Lago after federal officials in June removed 10 boxes worth of government records.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Another mass walkout bringing the UK's railway network to a grinding halt, causing major disruptions. Tens of thousands of signalers, maintenance workers, ticket collectors fighting for their rights as negotiations with the government for better pay and conditions hit the buffers.
I support the workers that are striking.
We're being inconvenienced, but they're being treated unequally.
Many rail employees, often working unsocial hours in a high-pressure environment, say they have seen no pay rise in 3 years, as the specter of soaring inflation, predicted to surpass 13% over the next year, looms over negotiations. The Conservative government has offered a below-inflation pay rise and accuses the unions organizing the strikes of taking the country for ransom. Despite that, public support for the strikes is on the rise.
I'm quite sympathetic to the train strikes. They're actually the other industrial unrest, because it comes on the back of minimal increase in wages over a long period of time, a pay freeze much more recently, and an offer which is frankly way, way, way below the current rate of inflation.
Stoking the public ire, comments by Conservative Prime Ministerial hopeful Liz Truss, who has pledged to restrict the ability of public sector workers to strike.
Liz Truss is seeking to take away human rights and the ability of the democratic right of people to express themselves through their trade unions and industrial action, which is one of the pillars of our democracy. It's only repressive regimes that stop people going on strike and stop them expressing themselves and stop them rebalancing the power in the workplace through their trade unions.
The opposition Labour Party, which receives funding from several trade unions itself, has also come under fire for failing to support the walkouts. The rail strikes, which also include London's underground and overground network, have set off a wave of industrial action that is set to get bigger, with teachers, health workers, and even barristers planning their own strikes.
Britain's so-called summer of discontent seems well underway, with a general strike more likely now than ever before, and with the railway workers in the eye of the storm. Saeed Pereza, London.
The Israeli military shot down seven Palestinian non-governmental civil society and human rights organizations in the occupied West Bank. Early on Thursday, the Israeli military raided occupied Ramallah and broke into the offices of the organizations. The offices were ransacked and their equipment confiscated. Doors were welded shut with an Israeli military order posted on them declaring the organizations unlawful. The groups have decried the move as politically motivated and baseless.
They are targeting by the seven organizations. They are targeting the civil society sector in Palestine and the human rights sector in general. So the message was any organization talked about, exposed the Israeli policy, talked about the Israeli crimes will be targeted and will be silent. Again, the message also for the international organizations and, of course, also for the EU states, those who are rejected the Israeli allegation against the organizations. This is a message that Israel is above the law.
Israel has outlawed six of these NGOs, which were labeled as terrorist organizations in October 2021, and accused them of funneling donor aid to militants and had ties to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a Palestinian left-wing movement. The organizations that have been outlawed by Israel are Ad-Damir and Al-Haq, which document human rights violations, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, Bissan Center for Research, DCI, Defense for Children International Palestine, as well as the Union of Agricultural Work Committees. The seventh organization was the Union of Health Work Committees.
We will continue our work. Work in this field, it's not a job. It's not a job. The Israelis continue their atrocities, their oppression against us, against the rest of the civil society organizations here. But this will not stop us, and this will not push us back, and we will not give up, and we will continue. We know that we pay price, maybe personal price, maybe different kind of a price, but we are ready to defend, to fight for the principles that we do believe.
The United Nations Human Rights Office has meanwhile expressed alarm at Israel's arbitrary closure of organizations and called on Israel to immediately reverse these decisions, reiterating the High Commissioner's call to revoke the designations of the organizations as terrorist and unlawful.
The Israeli regime has added to its illegal practices which aim to silence the Palestinian people. Today, not only does it continue to suppress Palestinian people, the regime also quells these organizations and human rights advocates. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Iranian Minister for Roads and Urban Development Rustam Qasimi, along with the delegation of 57 dignitaries from Iran, visited Islamabad on the sidelines of 21st session of Pak-Iran Joint Economic Commission. During the two-day visit, the Iranian delegation met Pakistan's Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari and discussed the bilateral ties between the two countries. Pakistan's Foreign Minister underlined the need to fully utilize the existing potential between Islamabad and Tehran in energy and air links. Addressing a press conference with the Iranian Roads and Urban Development Minister, Pakistan's Minister for Commerce, Naveed Qamar, said both sides have agreed to start negotiations on transit agreements that will allow the movement of goods without any additional taxes or tariffs.
We agreed on time frames for the PTA, which is to be negotiated between the two countries, and an ambitious target of 6 months has been set for that process.
The visiting Iranian minister, Rustam Qasimi, said the 21st session of Pakistan